2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Session 326, Committed Same-Sex Unions, is a theological accommodation possible? Participants H. Wayne Shaw and Edward L. Kimball.
Thank you so much for coming to the session today. Hi. Hi. Today we have the great fortune of having Dr. Scow speak to us and some comments from Dr. Kimball. A little bit about Dr. Scow. He has a doctorate in comparative literature from the University of Iowa, where his areas of concentration in his doctoral studies, Dr. Scow has a doctorate in comparative literature from University of Iowa, where his areas of concentration in his doctoral studies were English, German, and Dano-Norwegian literature of the 19th and 20th centuries. He's a professor emeritus of English at Idaho State University, where he was on the faculty from 1967 to 1999. Among his many administrative positions at ISU, he chaired the Department of English and Philosophy from 1988 to 1995. In addition to his scholarly publications, especially those on Martin A. Hansen, Henrik Ibsen, Karen Blixen, and his translation from Danish of Martin A. Hansen's stories, he co-edited the groundbreaking work on Gay and Lesbian Mormons, Peculiar People, which won a special award of merit from the Association of Mormon Letters. And he wrote the tribute to his son, Remembering Brad, on the loss of a son to AIDS. Dr. Scow has been a frequent presenter here at Sunstone and published frequently in the Sunstone magazine. In 1994, Dr. Scow was interviewed in the Academy Award-nominated documentary Straight from the Heart, a film which explored the difficulties of coming to terms with a gay or lesbian child. Dr. Scow.
Thank you. Does my voice come across all right? This is the first time I've had the luxury of being at Sunstone for all 3 days, and I must say that it's been just a very gratifying experience, and I'm happy to be here with you this morning, and I thank you for coming in. I think this particular hour had a number of extremely attractive presentations, and so I'm a little surprised to see as many of you here as are, but welcome. I have a paper to read to you. It's not too long. It starts out rather straightforwardly. In fact, in driving over this morning, I thought it is short, and I need some kind of a zinger for an opener, something that to give it some class or something memorable. And I couldn't think of anything. And then it occurred to me that those tapes that you can purchase and listen to people like Joseph Campbell or Deepak Chopra. And you remember how they start out? they always have about 7 to 10 seconds of music. It tends to be New Age music, which doesn't appeal to me very much, but kind of exotic, and I suppose it's intended to focus your attention and build up the sense of anticipation for what the guru is going to say. I'm not a guru, but unfortunately, perhaps it was too late for me at that point to arrange for the sound equipment, but I thought that we might begin by each of you selecting something that you would like to listen to in your head for 7 to 10 seconds, and you can start that right now. I think that I'll be playing Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony, and whatever works for you. We'll have that right now, and then we'll be ready to go. Actually, the very best opener that I could have had would have been for those of you who are here to have been in the immediately preceding session that was held in Wasatch 1 with the Stevensons and the Packards. It was an experiential approach. They described what it was like for them when they first learned that they have a gay child and how that impacted their lives when they knew someone who was gay, someone that they loved and admired. And And I think that's very important in coming to terms with this issue in our lives. In my own case, when I was wrestling with that dilemma, perhaps the biggest stumbling block for me was my sense of what my church thought about it and the theological objections to being homosexual were just really very big obstacles for me to overcome. And I suppose that's the reason that some of my thinking about this over the years since then has tended to focus on what I call the theological issues. Now, I feel a little diffident in talking about this because I'm not a trained theologian, and whenever I hear that someone is a theologian, it strikes me as describing someone of tremendous erudition, and I don't pretend to have that. And I confess that in billing this as a talk about the theological aspects of same-sex unions, I'm probably using theological in a pretty loose and general way. I suppose that all I meant initially was just that I wanted to talk about it from the perspective of what organized religions might have to say about the matter. And then in a slightly less general and slightly more appropriate way, I suppose what I'm trying to do here, and this sounds presumptuous and daunting, I suppose what I'm trying to do is to think about what God might have to say on the subject. After all, isn't that maybe an adequate working definition of what we mean by theological? We're trying to figure out what the mind and will of God are by whatever best means we can find access to. And so what I present to you this morning will not be any kind of a learned treatise, but simply a weaving together of some strands of my experience and my thinking. And I must say that I'm very happy to have you good folks here today to respond to the thoughts I'm going to present. I think that while I may express myself as being very sure of my opinions, I acknowledge that I may not know everything about this and that we can learn from each other. So I'm particularly happy to have Ed Kimball as a respondent to the paper. I'm sure we can consider very carefully, we'll want to consider very carefully what he has to say. And if we do have some time at the end, I hope maybe there are some of you who, in your thoughtful critique, will have suggestions to make in one way or another. If I have missed something important, I hope you'll call it to my attention. My starting point is the following proposition. Our governmental and religious institutions should sanction committed same-sex relationships. My principal purpose is to explore the theological grounds on which such a radical redirection can be justified. Let me say at the outset that I am perfectly content to preserve the word marriage to designate traditional heterosexual unions. That is what the word has always meant. We need not get sidetracked into an argument about semantics. What is needed is not an expansion of an already well-established definition, but rather an extension of some of the legal and psychological benefits of heterosexual married relationships to a substantively analogous form of commitment between persons. I am not unaware that in raising the possibility of sanctioning committed same-sex unions, I will seem to be challenging directly the present stance of the LDS Church. It is common knowledge that the Church has organized efforts to defeat political initiatives for legalization in several states and has committed substantial sums of money thereto. But I do not see my questioning of the present Church position as inappropriate, disloyal, or without ample precedent. After all, in the Judeo-Christian tradition and in recent Church history, there are numerous examples of significant course changes, changes that were in part brought about by altered conditions, by internal as well as broader cultural dialogue, by evolutionary moral growth. Examples of this include the revised view of God as the God of all human beings, not of Israel alone, the reinterpretation of the gathering of Israel, the cessation of the practice of polygamy, and the extension of the priesthood to black men. The church benefits from open dialogue, from rigorous examination of challenging questions, as a review of our 170-year modern history will show. In this spirit, I hope my observations can be regarded as constructive in their intent. And let me pause here to make another comment. I think it is possible that there are those on the outside who would see a Sunstone address on this subject as being challenging and unfriendly to the church. If you had been in the session that I referred to earlier, where the Stephensons and the Packards talked about their experience in wanting to help and do good things for these, our brothers and sisters, you would see that it is out of love for the church that we would like to see some rethinking on this matter. It is because somehow we feel that the church deserves to be the best it can, and this is an area in which, on the basis of our experience, we respectfully submit that perhaps we can do better. Much of the religious resistance to gay and lesbian civil unions is loosely based on biblical interpretation. It is true that a half dozen isolated passages make reference to homosexuality. But if read superficially and out of context, they can be misleading. Several biblical scholars have written insightfully about these contexts. One that I am familiar with and recommend to you is chapter 9 of John Spong's book, Living in Sin, which deals with the issues of sexuality and religion. The Bible is a complex document, an incomplete spiritual history of a particular evolving culture. The Latter-day Saints, who believe in continuing revelation, and by implication, continuing moral evolution, must logically acknowledge that the Bible does not contain necessarily final answers. Furthermore, because of the highly selective nature of historical writing and the inherent limitations of language itself, the Bible's pronouncements are frequently ambiguous and sometimes self-contradictory. Thus, we cannot avoid the burden of interpretation. The Bible has much to teach us, but its truths cannot be plucked out by simplistic proof texting. It must be interpreted holistically, and that includes reading it in the light of our ongoing experience and considering thoughtfully the implications of cultural evolution. To evaluate homosexual civil unions, we must look at the larger role of human sexuality. The biblical contradictions on the latter subject illustrate the need for holistic reading. One prominent strain of interpretation holds that sexuality is tied closely to the original sin, that it is intrinsic to our fallen condition and ideally to be suppressed. Since sexuality is seen as physical of this world, it undermines the realization of our higher spiritual nature. For those who cannot meet the lofty standard of celibacy, marriage is a kind of consolation prize. The Apostle Paul promoted this view. In his first letter to the Corinthians, he advised the unmarried to follow his example and remain so. Failing that, he allowed it was better to marry than to burn. At least sex confined within marriage perpetuates the species efficiently and minimizes the potential of sexual passion to disrupt society. At its extreme, this interpretation suggests that sexual relations in marriage ought ideally to be discontinued once conception ceases to be the goal. A more favorable view of marriage, and by implication of the sexual relation within it, can be found in the same Bible. God said of the solitary Adam in the garden, "It is not good for man to be alone." Adam and Eve were then joined together as helpmeets to love and support each other in the face of the challenges of living in the world. Presumably, aside from procreation, sexual bonding was beneficial to the end of strengthening love and commitment between partners. Most of us have adopted this view of sexuality within marriage and rejected Paul's position. We do this based on holistic interpretation and cognizance of our own experience. But the Bible prohibits adultery, fornication, and homosexual acts, say the religious conservatives. That means that even if sex in marriage is considered acceptable, sexual intimacy of any kind outside marriage is sinful. What about that? Here we must pause to consider why sexual prohibitions and moral tenets in general exist and how they come into being. There are those who seem to believe that moral rules originate at some universal level of abstraction, that they are decreed in the beginning by God, more or less arbitrarily, as a test of obedience. Thou shalt not. But if we look at historical evidence, we will see that the stages by which moral codes have evolved, based on human experience. I think you can see this just reading all the way through the Old and New Testaments. We will see that prohibitions are directly related to perceived negative effects of particular behaviors, not only as they affect individuals, but especially as they affect human relationships and the welfare of the larger society. In short, moral codes rest on a very practical relationship between acts and outcomes. We need to remember this when we attempt to assess moral questions. The fact is, it seems to me, I state this as though it's absolute fact, but it seems to me that religions have always been the guardians of social stability and have established conservative, generalized moral codes to promote it. This, I think, is evident in the Hebrew tradition, where the distinction between religion and state is often blurred. Thus, when analyzed, sexual prohibitions laid down in Scripture will be found to have a substantial basis in practical social concerns. Adultery is forbidden in order to secure faithfulness and stability in the marriage relationship, and thus reduce the disruptive social and psychological effects of sexual promiscuity. Fornication is forbidden because society needs to discourage relationships wherein the participants are not able to assume responsibility for the complex outcomes of sexual intimacy. Fornication implies leaping before making adequate preparation for obligations. Society doesn't want to deal with the attendant problems. Homosexual intimacy is forbidden based on a social perception that it undermines heterosexual bonding, procreation, and male protection of offspring, that it constitutes a threat to the traditional family. There is a generalized practical wisdom in these broad prohibitions of socially irresponsible sexual behavior. But if we believe that our sexuality is something more than inherent evil, Paul's idiosyncratic view notwithstanding, if we see our sexual nature as a vital part of our humanness, having the potential to raise us to a higher level of being, if we are to pursue the opportunity for growth inherent in this sexual nature, we must do more than simply say, "Thou shalt not." "Thou shalt not" is a blunt instrument. As in the Mormon preoccupation with alcohol and tobacco, "Thou shalt not" is an easy and sometimes heavy-handed marker that may cause us to emphasize the Pharisaical letter of the law and miss the larger view. "Thou shalt not" sets the bar low. In its negativity, it does not challenge us to find the more fulfilling, more sublime aspects of sexual relationship with another. Another way of saying this is that sexual morality can focus on a lower plane, analogous to the spirit of the Mosaic Law, or it can aspire to a higher level. For example, when sex in marriage is treated as an obligation, as a legal right to be insisted on, regardless of the feelings of one of the partners, literal conformity with the Mosaic commandment may be satisfied. There is no adultery. But the spirit of the law and its opportunity are missed. Such a relationship based on coercion, obligation, does not foster love and goodwill. Far from being virtuous, it is destructive rather than beneficial to the souls of both partners. Where in the scripture can we turn to find the needed positive guideposts to a higher sexual morality? In what has been preserved, Jesus said little on this subject directly, but indirectly, his teaching is filled with tenets that are highly relevant. Consider the following premises: that the kingdom of God is at least as much about the self-fulfillment of persons as it is about institutions. That the well-being of every individual person is important. That in our efforts to help others, we should accept their uniqueness, care for them in the context of their individual, not generalized, circumstances. Excuse me. That love is the first principle and should govern our relationships with others. Jesus' pronouncements and his behavior underscored these premises repeatedly. They are central in his gospel, the point of beginning in questions of morality. They challenge us to search for understanding and interpersonal fulfillment within a larger, more positive framework. God has given us the complex gift of sexuality and its accompanying responsibility. This gift has the power to bless or to impair our lives. If its expression is selfish, if sensual gratification is its sole raison d'etre, if it reduces the partner simply to an object, it will most likely lead to diminishment, ennui, and disillusionment. On the other hand, sex can be the ultimate expression of vulnerability, trust, and generosity. Ideally, it focuses the desire to be fully present to another, by which I mean to give oneself entirely to another, unselfishly, to be fully present to them, not reserved. As the primary ritual of interpersonal intimacy, it has the power to integrate the mysterious, soulful aspects of human life. Through it, the reductive division of body and spirit can be transcended. For an extended discussion of these rich potentialities of what sexuality can bring to our human realization, I recommend Thomas More's fine little book, The Soul of Sex. You see, what I'm trying to do here is to get the matter of same-sex unions considered not on the basis of what people do physically in the bedroom, but on the basis of love. The one may be subsumed under the other, but not necessarily. The application of these Christian principles to committed homosexual unions should be obvious. Humans normally need acceptance and security, and these are most powerfully fostered in intimate partnerships. In a world that continuously batters the self, each of us needs to know that another who cares deeply is there for us to defend, counsel, encourage, console, someone to share with us the dark as well as the light places on the mortal journey. For this reason, pairing is a normal desire, a normal need. Heterosexual couples may not experience such companionship perfectly, but who in choosing to marry is not grateful for the chance to grow within this nurturing condition, with society's unambiguous ritual blessing and continuing encouragement? How many married couples would falter were it not for that social support? Now here's the main point. Biology, divine intent, call it what you will, has made some in the human family different in the nature of the deepest intimacy they seek with another. And the nature of this longing is more than just superficially sexual. That's what I was trying to say a minute ago. Moreover, powerful evidence shows that the gender direction of love's longing is mysterious and not finally a matter of conscious volition. Whatever the cause, the main outlines of Jesus' teaching suggest that we should encourage these persons to find personal growth responsibly within the parameters of their God-given unique nature, not insist that they conform to some other one-size-fits-all pattern of longing. Jesus believed in keeping priorities straight. The Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath, he said on one occasion. He would probably say something in the same vein about sexual rules. Do we care enough about the well-being of our homosexual brothers and sisters to allow them a socially approved supporting structure of love and acceptance and security, such as married heterosexuals enjoy? The opportunity to grow together in sustained, committed intimacy? In this case, what finally do we gain by clinging to the negativity of a generalized, uncaring, heavy-handed, "thou shalt not"? Jesus did say we should judge human behaviors by their fruits. It is not good for a man or a woman to be alone. If two people of whatever gender commit to each other that they will love and cherish and support each other without reservation, is it not likely that such commitment will bear good fruit? And ought we not to support that? I have argued that it is in the best interest of gays and lesbians, if they so choose, to have their committed unions socially and religiously recognized, that such recognition would help to make available to them the kind of sustained intimacy that is conducive to a unified personality and to the soul's growth, a keystone of personal happiness. But an important question remains. Would society's best overall interests be served thereby? Would the existence of sanctioned same-sex unions misdirect the longings of individuals who could otherwise be heterosexually attracted? Would such unions be so common that heterosexual marriage would be statistically undermined? Would such unions weaken the concept and viability of the family in our society? These questions, after all, fall under the purview of theology, broadly defined. The preponderance of evidence suggests that these negative outcomes are highly unlikely. The fact is that the gender direction of sexual attraction is established early and remains relatively constant in individuals, and thus acceptance of the legitimacy of committed same-sex unions would not change the relative proportion of homosexual, heterosexual persons in the population, nor adversely influence individual behaviors. The fear that genuinely heterosexual persons would be recruited to homosexual orientation and behavior if society were to legitimize committed same-sex unions is ungrounded. The fact is that when homosexuals attempt to enter into marriage, that is, heterosexual marriage, against their true nature, usually in a misguided attempt to conform to social expectations. The result is frequently great dysfunction and unhappiness for the couple and others around them. Not merely the couple, but others around them. That so many such marriages either fail outright or persist unhappily is evidence of their flawed basis. It cannot be in society's best interest to perpetuate such suffering. The fact is that the birth rate is unlikely to be significantly altered, since the number of homosexuals who would choose to forego traditional marriage, in which they would likely be miserable, in order to enter into committed same-sex unions, where their chance of happiness is greater, is statistically very small. The fact is, and I would like to stress this point, that blaming the declining state of the family and society today on recognition of homosexuality and fair treatment of homosexuals has little basis. If the traditional family as a social unit is under siege, the reasons lie largely elsewhere. For example, in growing materialism, two working parents. That can't help the traditional family very much. In the diminished real authority exerted by religions, which can't, people who don't allow their religious affiliations to keep them in marriages or in the same kinds of family relationships that once they felt coerced to stay in. If the family is declining, it is perhaps because of the progress in women toward equality and financial freedom, which allows them to escape being trapped in undesired marital relationships. In education and governmental policies which offer that freedom of choice to women. Those things have a profound effect on where the family is these days, I think much more than the fair recognition of homosexuality and fair treatment of homosexuals. Paradoxically, considered in terms of society's best interests, by sanctioning committed same-sex unions, we would be far more likely to solve some existing social problems than to give rise to new ones. It is ironic that in its rigid condemnation of homosexuality, the religious right seems to ignore not only the basic human needs of individuals who belong to a normal minority, but ignores also the best interests of society. If religious conservatives deplore sexual promiscuity, and if they wish to foster social stability, personal responsibility, and personal spiritual growth, don't they see that they really should support legalized gay and lesbian unions? Homosexual couples could then reasonably be held to similar standards of mature fidelity expected of heterosexual couples. Wouldn't that be a step in the right direction? I am the father of a young man who died of AIDS. It is a long story. But the bottom line is that he might not have contracted that disease had his family, his church, and his general culture been informed with a true Christian vision of his personal uniqueness and of how they could have encouraged and supported him to find the better path of a committed relationship. That is, that's my sense of a true Christian vision. A committed relationship. That really was what he desired. But we all put stumbling blocks in his way. I regret that at that crucial time, I lacked the vision and the courage to stand up for him. But it is not too late now to help others like him. Theologies are not static. They change as a reflection of our openness to further light and knowledge. At issue here is our willingness to learn from our collective experience as we go forward. With keener insight on our part, the vision of higher aspiration to which Christ called us ultimately should trump the lesser Mosaic law of thou shalt not. More love, more interpersonal commitment, and the deeply realized, enduring happiness that flows from them are good, not bad. That seems to me elementary. If enough of us understand this and have the courage to say so, the time will come when our collective moral evolution will occasion new scripture and a better world.
It's hard for me to stand as long as it takes to read the paper, so if you'll forgive me, I'll sit and read from here. If you need to see the glorious growth of my beard, you can kind of adjust in between. Wainscow has obviously thought deeply and cares a great deal about the subject of the discussion for today. I don't see my assignment as offering a rebuttal to what he says. I agree with much of it, most of it. It's simply, I think, an opportunity for me to make my own observations about the subject. The church position is perfectly clear and simple. It is that even if same-sex attraction is beyond conscious control, homosexual conduct is voluntary and sinful. Let me first identify some of the things this discussion is not about. It's not about whether homosexual orientation is voluntary, that is, chosen. It's not about legal concepts like equal protection of the laws or about the desirability of so-called gay marriage laws, not even about the notion of fairness and equity. It's only about the question that Wayne Scow poses today, and that is whether the church could and should change its position on about one category of homosexual conduct, and that is sex between gay people who are in a committed relationship. We need to be clear that in his answering yes to both the questions whether the church can and whether it should change its position, he's not urging that there should be unrestricted sexual activity. Even if the secular law lifts all restrictions on adult consensual sexual conduct, as it seems well on its way to doing, he would oppose sex outside of a committed relationship, both for heterosexual and homosexual partners. He says that with sex goes responsibility, and he would reject fornication or adultery and their gay equivalents. He's endorsed only one segment of the spectrum of gay sexual conduct, and he does it on a premise that in that particular context it fosters human psychic development through reciprocal expression of love. And that's an understandable position. It's not an unfamiliar concept. With respect to the heterosexual union, the church states, sexual relations within marriage are divinely approved not only for the purpose of procreation, but also as a means of expressing love and strengthening emotional and spiritual bonds between husband and wife. The church position on this narrower issue is also clear. It is that gay sex in all circumstances, including those within a committed relationship, is clearly proscribed by those who have been given the leadership responsibility in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Once the church used to find support of its position in public policy and law, but that support is rapidly eroding. Church leaders frequently cite Scripture, but as Wayne said, there is not an unambiguous argument to be based on Scriptures alone, because the handful of passages that are taken as condemning all homosexual conduct are, by reason of vagueness or ambiguity or the special circumstances in which they're expressed, susceptible to interpretations that are narrower. That is, that homosexual sex is forbidden in some circumstances, but short of the general applicability that is urged for it. But there's a difference in the Mormon context, because those scriptures are interpreted with authoritative emphasis by modern church leaders, which gives them a meaning that that is orthodox without its having necessarily passed the test of scholarly scrutiny about all the circumstances in which it might have been written. Ultimately, the church's position comes down primarily to an assertion of authoritative teaching. That's not an insignificant fact for Mormons. Statements by modern church leaders are powerful. They're frequently equated in a general way with Scripture or with the Word of God. And the literature of the church, by which I mean the statements and writings of the church leaders, is heavy with characterizations of homosexual conduct as sinful, without making a distinction as to the subset. Statements by individual leaders may have limited status by themselves, but in this case, they have the impact of unanimity. There is no dissenting voice. And statements by the combined leadership of the church have a higher status yet. The 1995 proclamation of the first presidency and the 12 on the family has several passages that relate to our topic. On a lawyerly, careful, literal, textual analysis, one can take the language of those passages as susceptible to different meanings. But I think that's inappropriate, because if you take it in the historical context, that is, the time and place and historic events in which it is expressed, it seems to me clearly intended to oppose both legal recognition of same-sex relationships, partnerships, or civil unions, as they're called, and also to oppose as sinful any homosexual conduct, any sexual conduct in a gay relationship. Well, the first issue is, could the church make such a radical turn in the road as Wayne proposes? And I have no difficulty in saying yes, it could, as long as we're talking about possibility and not probability. The second question is whether the church should change its position, and on that I have a somewhat different view than Wayne has. I think it's relevant for you to understand where I sit in the spectrum of possible viewpoints. They're the extremes. The church leaders are right and inspired and they have my support, or the leaders are wrong and therefore not inspired and I'm out of here. And then there's the middle, which I think occupies a great many of us, and that is, I don't have any real opinion about this and I'm content to just wait and see what happens. Then there's the more nuanced responses or positions. One is, I believe the leaders have been called of God and to speak often under inspiration, but I believe they are also subject to error, and I think they're wrong this time. But I will continue to support them otherwise. I will not be an adversary, but I will encourage their continuing reconsideration of the matter. I think that's somewhat close to Wayne's position, though he should characterize his position for himself. My own is slightly different. It is something like this. Even though I don't understand a lot of things, and I don't believe everything I've been taught, I do believe the church is true in this sense, that while its leaders are not infallible, it is the organization that God has caused to arise and has given a special responsibility to preach Christ and to offer saving ordinances to mankind. Maybe you'll understand me better if I say I believe the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is the truest church. As such, I believe its leaders are entitled to and do receive inspiration and revelation. Even though I believe my leaders are sometimes in error, I give to them what a lawyer terms the benefit of a presumption of correctness. That is, I will follow them unless I could not conscientiously do so. Now, one avenue of change is reinterpretation of the scriptures. Wayne suggests that they pose no real impediment to change. I think he overstates his case, given the added weight of interpretation to those scriptures that have been given by modern church leaders. In practice, I think a significant reinterpretation of the biblical scriptures would require authoritative pronouncements that have essentially revelation. You can also get changed sometimes by debate and logic, argumentation, but the church's position is not based on logic or reason. It's based on authority, and that is not susceptible to change by logic or discussion, or by debate rather, discussion maybe. On the other hand, the church is no stranger to change. Mormon acceptance of the principle of continuing revelation is real. It provides a means for sudden and even radical change. The most obviously historical examples, Wayne's already mentioned, the preaching of the gospel of Jesus to the Gentiles, the termination of plural marriage, and in our time, the extension of priesthood eligibility to men of all races. If any major change were to come with respect to the status of gays, it would almost certainly be by a direct statement from the top, and in all probability by revelation, that changes our understanding of some very basic aspects of human nature and of the mortal experience. Change by way of new revelation is in some senses unpredictable and unexpected. However, given the historical view of things, it seems to me that significant change in the church's direction has come when the two things happened. One is a heightened concern about the issue, and the second is going to God for guidance. Now, there's certainly in these days a heightened concern about the issues. It comes partly from the legal and political developments concerning sexuality. The church has opposed legal status for same-sex unions, but there's a serious possibility that over the next few years, many of the states of this country will recognize such unions, as have several countries in Europe. There's also a heightened concern that has come from the increasing number of church members who have openly identified themselves as gay. One of the strongest motivations we know is concern for the welfare of a loved one. There are few of us who don't have family and friends with close association with someone gay. As there are more such people out, it becomes ever harder to think of gay people as other. But even with such heightened motivation to know what the answer is, and with the diligent prayer of church leaders, new revelation of the divine will is not something one can demand or expect or plan for. It'll come when it comes. There is, however, a slower kind of change that may be coming. As with other churches, the LDS Church changes in its practice and understanding over time, a little here and a little there. Some examples. There was a time when confession was public rather than private. There was a time when women didn't pray in sacrament meeting. There was a time when the gathering of the saints to build Zion in the United States was preached, but that emphasis shifted 100 years ago. There was a time when the use of contraception was condemned, but that teaching has been subsumed by the current instruction that a decision as to how many children to have and when to have them is extremely intimate and private and should be left between the couple and God. To a substantial degree, LDS practice and tradition seems to move with the surrounding culture, although with a decidedly conservative bias, so that the change is always well behind the secular society. The status of homosexual couples is also changing in the churches. While there are a number of so-called conservative churches, particularly the Catholics, the Evangelicals, and the Mormons, who have held fast to their positions, many denominations not only allow formal celebration of same-sex unions, but allow for sexually active gay clergy. We don't know what the future will bring. It may be that the church becomes more and more militant in its opposition. But it may also be true that there will gradually come to be more tolerance of same-sex relationships, even if there be no formal change in the church's statement of its prohibition. In recent years, the church has more clearly distinguished between inclination and act. That there is no sin in having homosexual inclinations, even though gay sexual relations are certainly sin. And as gay parents, gay persons, sit in the same pew and sing the same hymns with us, that association will have an effect that may be more important than any other kind. Over time, it's possible, too, that the church disciplinary process will become less stringent as it looks for a possible way to keep people in the church rather than acting for a quick, clean excommunication. Presently, disciplinary procedures often result in excommunication for sexual activity if there's no commitment to stop. One step would be to make disfellowshipment the norm rather than excommunication. Although that severely restricts participation in the church, it does retain membership for those gay persons who still value their membership. Another possible ameliorating step would be a bishop-imposed restriction on full church participation without formal action. For example, one couldn't have a temple recommend, but might head the ward activities committee. Wouldn't be called to an administrative or teaching position, but might serve as a secretary or clerk or ward organist. Something like this happens now with a person who doesn't observe the word wisdom. I wouldn't be surprised if it already happens quietly in some places with respect to same-sex individuals and couples. Changes of that sort wouldn't denigrate the church's position that the only fully acceptable place for sexual expression is in marriage. Gays who remain celibate, who limit themselves to a non-sexual relationship, could continue to participate fully in the church as they are free to do now. But for those who say that celibacy is simply too much to expect of them, they need to see that the same is expected of all persons until they're married. And that a number of heterosexual persons, too, who are for physical or social reasons never able to marry, are expected that same to live by that same standard the rest of their life. So it is not unique to them that standard is set. But if a gay person chooses not to refrain from sexual activity, then the church would, under the situation I posit, hold them in a kind of a class apart with restricted membership and leaving ultimate resolution of where the line should be drawn between right and wrong to the heavenly judge. Sins are not all equal, and it seems to make perfect sense to me that a gay person in a committed monogamous relationship be treated differently than a gay person who's openly promiscuous, who's focused on sex for its own sake, for its own pleasure, and nothing more. There may be what we'd call prohibited sexual activity in both of those cases from the church's point of view, but I think we can see that there's a difference in the significance of the conduct. I make no prediction about any change in the stated position of the church, but there are some things that gays and their family and friends can do now. They can continue to participate in the church fully and to be there to help provide an environment when those gay members who wish to continue in the church will feel less alone, more accepted. It hardly needs to be said that the church isn't an easy place for gays today. If it were otherwise, I guess we wouldn't be meeting here. Gay people may well, in anger or sorrow or frustration, discontinue their participation in the church. But that should not dictate the actions of their family or friends, who should stay, at least as long as they continue to believe the church to be true, as I do. If their hope is that the church change, they're going to be more useful to that cause if they exercise patience and show loyalty. Their leaving will not affect change. Their staying might make a difference. The church is particularly resistant to change when it's pressed by its adversaries, but it's somewhat open to insiders asking the difficult questions that could cause our leaders to seek revelation. Those believers who would be gratified by change should pray earnestly, but for guidance, without being certain in their own minds as what the answer is. We don't always understand the will of God, and we must usually be satisfied with direction and not explanation. There are a lot of possible ways in which our prayers on a subject like this might be answered. The answer might be, you're right, speak up. It might be, you're wrong, try a different approach. It might be, this is none of your business. It might be, not now, be patient.
Questions or comments. We've been asked that you, if you have questions, to come up to the mic so that everybody can hear you.
Just a quick comment. I enjoy these very much. As a member of the Affirmation for some 27 years, Affirmation is a gay and lesbian organization for Mormons who are struggling with these issues and to try to help them understand them. I have seen hundreds, literally hundreds, because you meet thousands of people being in that organization, hundreds who married because they were encouraged to, that was going to solve the problem. Later down the line, they couldn't live the lie anymore, and it broke up families and left their wives and husbands wondering what it was all about. On the other hand, I have seen many, many, opposed to what most people think, who chose to be together, and they have spent 25, 30 years together as not a married couple, but living as a married couple. I just lived next to a couple who'd been together for 25 years. They were well-loved at Leisure World in California, where I was, and contributed a lot to society. And another two met when they were deacons in their ward, and the bishop tried to keep them apart, but couldn't. And they have lived together now for 70-some years. One of the partners just died recently at age 85, and they've lived a wonderful life, two chiropractors who contributed a lot to society. I'm not going to comment on it, just I've seen both extremes. Thank you for this.
Hi, I'm a temple-married heterosexual who would like to respectfully disagree with the respondent's position. I think you'd be hard-pressed to support your position that the church has changed from inside pressure. If you look at polygamy, if you look at blacks, I think most prominently that pressure came from outside of the church. To say that I could be loyal to the church and enjoy the benefits of my marriage to the exclusion of my two brothers who are gay, I think is disrespectful to them. And I know we're all at different positions in considering this question, but it has become my experience that I counsel most gay Mormons to leave as quick as possible and begin the healing. And for heterosexual couples who have gay family members to do the same and to join and build up communities that are respectful and supportive of our gay brothers and sisters.
I would say also that if I had a gay son who could not live in the church, I'd tell him to leave. I mean, that seems to me simple statement of truth. On the other hand, for those of us who do believe that the church is true, we're in a little bit of a bind, aren't we? I choose to stay and to express my views, and those who cannot do that, of course, will not do that.
Could I add just a comment or two about the same question raised about adversity causing church to change versus it coming from a trickle-down revelation from the top? In 1969, Hubie Brown had essentially taken over the leadership of the church because President McKay was very ill, couldn't even sign his signature, I don't think. At that time, having not agreed with the black priesthood policy for quite some time, he took the prerogative to poll members of the hierarchy of the church in the 12, and received not only support from his counselor, Tanner, but also from 11 of the 12 council of 12, a unanimous vote, not based on any lightning bolt revelation, just a practical matter of this policy has gone too far. We're having eggs thrown on BYU basketball players, and having been one at one time, I relate to that. They were, Hubie Brown had to close the gates of the temple because some people were coming in to put explosives. For the first time, the organ played to a dead, quiet audience of zero. The pressures, when Stanford finally said, we're withdrawing our support, we will not compete with BYU anymore, President Brown finally said, enough is enough. There is no scriptural basis for this policy. All of the pillars upon which it was built and established when Brigham Young in 1852 stood before a joint session of the state legislature and said, this is the way it's going to be. It was not a policy as I know it to have been developed by the prophet, and there is no revelation stated any place about the policy. Therefore, when President Kimball, who was present during this time, when Harold B. Lee, having been absent from the vote, came back and single-handedly reversed a policy that was ready to be changed without any bold revelation announcement, President Kimball went very methodically through a process of polling every single member of the 12 years later, 9 years later, before this policy was changed in 1978. And then came the inspiration, and then came the revelation, this is a done deal, and then they made the announcement. I think the exact same thing is going to happen with the gay policy. I think it's going to be civil rights, and it's going to be gay rights that will cause them to be motivated to change. Thanks.
Let me just respond. I think that that's not accurate. That is, that there was no significance to inside influence. To say that there were outside influences is unquestionable. But to say that there was no consequence of people inside the church expressing their views, being, acting, and communicating, it's all cumulative. It certainly isn't one or the other. It is both.
Thank you. I would just like to make a comment about a class that I took at the University of Utah. I had been asked to lecture in the advanced sexuality class on child abuse, and I attended the entire class. The part that was on homosexuality, the teacher had enough foresight to bring in panels of homosexuals to explain to us what their lives were like, especially in Utah. And the most impressive lecture that I attended was parents of homosexuals who came from Provo and Salt Lake City, who had, as Brother Shao has, finally come to terms with the fact that this child has always been different, and that this isn't a choice they made after they got hormones. You know, they had always been different, and that it was something to do with, as the scientists say now, between 8 and 12 weeks when the hormone wash comes over the fetus, that all fetuses are neutral until that time, and that's when something happens, and that it could easily be that it went one way or the other. That isn't the point I want to make. The point I want to make is that these parents told the stories of what their children had been through and what they had been through in their wards in Salt Lake City and Provo. The most heartbreaking one was that when the daughter recognized that she, as a university student in Provo, that she could only relate emotionally and sexually to women, she went and talked to her bishop and said, I mean, she hadn't even acted on it yet, but that she knew she was gay, and that she had tried and tried and tried everything she could do to deny it, and that she wasn't acting on it, but she wanted him to know that she knows this about herself and has not yet decided what she's going to do about it. By the time it got out to everyone in the ward, they not only completely alienated and made her an outcast, but the parents too. The father wouldn't even come to talk about it the day we had the panel. He was so angry. He's a physician in Provo. The wife came and told that now their ward is holding them responsible for their poor parenting because she has turned out this way, and that the people actually don't even want to sit on the same pew with them. She was sobbing while she was saying this, and I really, really couldn't bear to see her suffering. And finally, when they asked for questions after, I felt compelled to say that there is a great difference between religiosity and spirituality, and that some people are very blessed to have a great deal of both. Others are not, and we must look upon them as being very handicapped, and perhaps that we'll learn to forgive. I also was in one of Chuck Hunt's classes, a professor who was very interested in the fact that Utah has the highest suicide rate of young men between 19 and 25 of any state in the Union. This is fact. So he had his graduate students start to interview the parents of the suicides. And in every case, that it was a homosexual, they couldn't bear the thought of living with the kind of prejudice against them. They would rather be dead. The prejudice is expressed, especially in Utah, but among all Mormons. My husband played on the University of Utah basketball team at one time in a former incarnation, and we just had one of his former teammates tell us that their son had just committed suicide for the same reason, that they were treated so terribly by everyone around them that he decided he would rather be dead. And they blame the church for it, but I don't think they should. I think the church, actually my respect for Joseph Smith went through the ceiling when I read two different accounts of saying to people that some revelations came from God and some came from man, and sometimes he didn't know the difference. That to me has saved me for a lot of things that have come down. I believe the church is true when it's true, and I believe that there are times when it's not. And that doesn't mean the church. That means certain proclamations and teachings and things that go out over the pulpits, such as we were sitting in our sacrament meeting when it came that it was a sin to be cremated. And my mission was in Japan, where it's against the law to be buried any other way. And I'm going, what? You know, we have to start exporting the dead Japanese to some other country to be buried. But anyway, that was rescinded because it was put out before there was any knowledge behind it. And I think that that same thing can happen about other things. And I just want to say that, yes, I support the leaders of the church in almost everything, but not in some things. And I never lie to get a temple recommend. I tell the exact truth when the questions are asked about what I believe. And I have never been denied a recommend. So there must be some progress being made.
Thank you all so much for your comments, and thank you to the presenters today.
This was taped, wasn't it?